Hodgepodge Podcast. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Integrals and differentials, fluence and flexion, infinitesimals and limits, points and slopes on a graph. These are some of the scare words around calculus that have tortured the mathematically challenged, that have scared people right away from the elegant pleasures of the 17th century science of complex motion and curving shapes and surfaces. This is the one-hour calculus conversation, Connection listeners. Not calculus for dummies, not calculus made easy either, but rather a polite getting-to-know-you walk around the mathematical trick underlying modern measurement of almost everything. The German philosopher and diplomat Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz and the English genius Isaac Newton get credit for nailing the idea of calculus independently and almost simultaneously around the year 1670. It was one of those odd breakthroughs that the Greek ancients like Archimedes had halfway anticipated. It was an answer that wasn't entirely understood or absorbed by lesser minds until long after Newton's time, well into the 19th century. But it's the stuff that our guests, Robert and Ellen Kaplan, put before their wide-open math circle without pretense or embarrassment as the sort of knowledge that lots of us can learn to love. Connection listeners, sharpen a pencil. Graph paper might help, but the main thing is relax. We're learning how to learn the calculus this hour. The phone isn't necessary either, but it might help. Ours is 1-800-423-8255. Our calculus problem number one is on the Connection website at theconnection.org. Check it out. Bob Kaplan, walk us through it.
Well, here's the problem. It's a beautiful spring morning, and a robin is hopping around on the grass under your satellite dish, which is pointed straight up. Those dishes are parabolic reflectors, which means that their cross-section is a parabola. The equation for this parabola is y equals x squared. That's not scary. It just means that whatever x you put in, x squared will come out. So if 3 goes into this equation, 9 will come out. Well, x, by the way, is the horizontal distance from the bottom of the parabola. Well, the robin is about 1.5 feet from the base of the dish when it looks up, and what does it see? Breakfast. There's a nice, juicy-looking bug crawling up the outside of the dish, 3 feet from its center. So that means, what, 3 squared equals 9. 9 feet up the side of the dish. You've got a very big dish to pull in all those exotic channels. The robin thinks to itself, I'll just fly up and snag that bug. And that's what it does. It flies up in a slanted, straight line and just skims the bug off the outside of the reflector and has as leisurely a breakfast in the air as any transatlantic passenger. Well, you've been waiting for the question. Here's the question. What was the slant of its straight line flight path? What was the slope of that line? Before we're done today, calculus will give us the answer.
You mean the robin knows calculus?
It does indeed. It has to, you know, it keeps its hands behind its back or in its pockets, those wings of it. And if it's going to know how to economize on effort, it better know some calculus the way bees do.
I've diagrammed the y equals x squared. It's a sort of, it's a steep arc, but it has this rather mysterious curve about it. What does calculus do in sort of helping make that meaningful? This curve of if the y-axis is vertical, the x-axis is horizontal, and you go up on y for the square of every x, what do we learn there, and how does calculus decode it?
Well, how does calculus decode that problem? How does calculus decode the world for us? This is incredibly important, because what we want to understand is change. With that curve, we want to understand the changing slope of it, the changing steepness. The world in flux, the world in motion, this is what's so important for us to understand.
Because if you think...
Ellen Kaplan.
If you think of the way you describe motion when you're a kid in school doing those Mr. Jones gets in his car and drives 50 miles an hour problems, the assumption is that you get in your car and you go continually 50 miles an hour. Hmm. But all of us who have ever actually been in a car know that the gas pedal is called the accelerator, and that you're really talking about a lot of change, which arithmetic and algebra simply can't handle.
Those splendid Greeks took snapshots of stillness and came to grips with the architecture of things. They gave us our geometry, they gave us the roots of our algebra, but we need to go beyond that. Well, when, Ellen? Starting with the Renaissance?
I'd say starting with Galileo. I mean, when you're talking about motion and you begin to move away from that medieval still center and talk about the swing of the planets and the stars and wonder how their rates are changing, how the motion takes place in this universe.
Let's take another sports example. I love the image of the bird knowing it has to sort of hit a curve and somehow does calculate it. A football quarterback knowing that his receiver is running in an arc and is probably varying his speed around a blocker knows the same thing, but knows from practice how to, where to meet the target, where to hit a moving target. Where does calculus come in? We've spoken of Newton's apple, but how did Leibniz and Newton sort of conceive this problem? What was the problem they were trying to solve, and then what was the answer that calculus gave them?
They were trying to solve the question, how do we come to grips with motion? How do we understand how things change? At what rates they change? What arc should you move in to intercept a flying ball, to have your rocket intercept a planet in its course? How can you explain the position of a planet in terms of time and acceleration? And the first thing you have to do is express all these changes in terms of functions. A function is a machine that you put numbers in and numbers come out. Input, then a rule, and then an output.
So you could have a rule like whatever I encounter, I paint blue. That would be a machine which had a particular function. A mathematical function, whatever you put in, I add two to it.
Or in the case of that Bob introduced, wherever you find an x, square it,
exactly,
and you get y. Okay, what's Newton playing with here as he looks at the planets or thinks about the apple? What are his functions?
Well, he's looking at ellipses when he's looking at planets. He's looking at parabolas when he's thinking about apples falling or balls being thrown up. And if you think of this now, each point on the graph of a function, the graph just being the visual image of these inputs and outputs, each point on that graph will have two addresses, a horizontal x address, a vertical y address. And we know how to put those addresses on, but can we explain how the graph is getting steeper? At what rate it's getting steeper? How steep it is at a particular point on it? That's what Newton wanted to come to grips with.
And you get something right away with that y equals x squared, where if you just put in a few spots and say, if we put in a 1, out comes a 1, if we put in a 2, out comes a 4, but then we say if you put in a 3, out comes a 9, and you can see that you're rising higher for every one you go across.
Right.
The going up is getting steeper and steeper and steeper.
You've got a sort of narrow champagne glass here.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And you're wondering, does it keep on getting steeper forever and ever and ever? How does the steepness change? That's the kind of question that you'd be worrying about.
And what the Greeks could deal with, and mathematicians before Newton and Leibniz, was the slope of straight lines. We understand that. The slope of a line is how much it goes up over how much you've gone along, rise over run.
That's the language of railroad trains, where it's very important because you cannot get a train driving straight up the Rocky Mountains. You have to figure how steep a hill a train can go up. And it's actually very little. It's like 1 foot rise for 132 feet across.
Very shallow slope. So we understand the slopes of straight lines. How can we understand the slope of a curved line? Does it even mean anything to say that a curved line has a slope? Well, it can't mean much the way I've put it, because the slope would have to keep changing if you look at our parabola, at our dish. So the great insight of Newton and of Leibniz independently was to see how to apply what we know, the slope of straight lines, to the slope of a curved line at a point on it. And this is the secret of mathematics, to extend what you know to what you want.
This is the tangent, but was not the tangent a lot older than Leibniz and Newton?
Archimedes knew about tangents, Euclid did too, the tangent to a circle, that the tangent is always perpendicular to the radius of a circle. But what was new with the invention of the calculus was getting tangents to other objects like a parabola and figuring out how the slope of that tangent would change and precisely what that slope was at each point.
So you approximate to your curve with a bunch of lines, which are going to be those tangent lines, and if you can find the slope of those lines, then you can say you're talking about the slope of the curve, in a sense.
Can you walk us through what Newton discovered? We'll take Newton with no prejudice. We won't extend that rivalry with Leibniz, but Newton was speaking English anyway. It seems a little bit closer to where we are. Walk us through the moment, or the problem that he set himself, and then the answer that calculus gave him.
Why don't we do it in terms of our robin and that dish?
Sure.
Let's try to figure out actually what the slope of a parabola is at that point where the bug is, that point 3 across, 9 up, 3 comma 9. Well, what Newton did was this. Put a straight line through that point, 3 comma 9, and through a neighboring point. How about 4 and whatever its height is going to be? Well, this is the x squared graph, so you put in 4, you get out 16. Put a straight line through 3 comma 9 and 4 comma 16. We can certainly get its slope. The amount it rises, the height, will be 16 minus 9. So that's 7. And the amount that we've gone along to get that far is 4 minus 3. So that's 1. A slope of 7 over 1. A slope of 7. That's certainly going to be close to what we want. But it's probably too steep. Because after all, that straight line doesn't fit our curve very well. It's going through two points on it. And as you said, Chris, we want the tangent. We want the line just touching the curve at
that point. So why don't you choose a point that's closer to 3, not as far away as 4?
Maybe 3.5.
Except that gets us into fractions. And that's a lot of unpleasant arithmetic.
No one wants to square 3.5. Certainly not on the air. Well, why don't we just move a little bit to the right of 3? Let's use the letter L for little. We'll move to 3 plus L horizontally, and its vertical address is that quantity, 3 plus L squared.
Which is 9 plus 6L plus L squared.
If you're worried about that 6L in the middle, you're multiplying a sum by a sum. You're going to get 4 terms, and 2 of them will be 3L. Add them up, and you get 6L. Okay, so the height at our first point is 9. The height at the second point is 9 plus 6L plus L squared. So the difference in the heights, well, just subtract the 9, and you get 6L plus L squared. That's the height of this little segment of a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
And the length that we've gone along is from 3 to 3 plus L. The length is L. So the slope of that line, the rise over run, is 6L plus L squared divided by L. You divide by L. Well, that's not going to be too hard. 6L divided by L gives us 6. L squared divided by L gives us L. We've got it. The slope of that line is 6 plus L. What line? The line going through our point, 3 comma 9, and some point just to the right of it.
Well, you want the point slope to be right at 3.9. So what you probably want to do is let L get smaller.
In fact, let's let it shrink right down to 0. Oh, well, there we are. You shrink L down to 0, the slope of that line just touching the curve at 3.9 is 6. It's exactly 6. That's what the Robin, that's what we wanted to know.
I actually have a conscientious objection at this point, because if you remember when we set up our rise over run, L was our run, which means it was the bottom of a fraction. And I have long been brought up to be frightened about the idea of dividing by 0, since if you can divide by 0, you've destroyed all of mathematics. And that doesn't seem a nice thing to do on a Tuesday morning. What about we say L just gets very small, and then a little smaller than that?
And so on.
Well, teensy and the square of teensy, which is wincy.
But you're just not going to let it be 0.
I'm going to let it get smaller and smaller, but I'm not going to let it be 0.
Well, that sounds like a good compromise, and it's the one that Newton and Leibniz and 2.5 centuries of people wrangling about this afterward came to. We can't divide by 0, we can't let L be 0, but we can let it get as close to 0 as you like.
I'm just following this with my own little pen and paper here, but it seems to me you finessed the whole thing. You managed not to divide by 0. You subtracted 0. You divided by L before you called it 0, and I thought you get around that problem.
Yeah, I did that by just moving my hands very fast, by factoring out the L from the top, dividing the L from the bottom into it. The L in the denominator had disappeared, and then I could let L go to 0. But is that really legitimate?
It's a nice philosophical question. Can you say, at this moment in time, L is not 0, but 1 minute later, it's okay if L is 0? Or are you going to say, take the Greek position and say, if something...
Well, Robert Kaplan, I should have said at the beginning, wrote the book on 0 called The Nothing That Is, A Natural History of 0. So you know more about 0 than you need for this discussion. But it seems to me the only thing you cannot, the only no-no with 0 is dividing by it. And we've managed in that little proof to avoid that. But go back. So this is marvelous. You figured that the slope at that point, 3 out, 9 up, is 6/1, and that's kind of a breakthrough. Was that the light that dawned on Newton?
That was the light, that you could now figure out the slope of a curve at a point on it. That parabola has a slope of 0 down at its base, a slope of 2, 4, greater, 6, and so on. Steeper and steeper slope as you go up, and you can now figure out that slope precisely, as long as you can get around the problem that Ellen brought up of not seeming to divide by 0 at certain times and dividing by it at others. And the way around that is this notion of limits, of getting close to 0, tolerance.
Tolerance, if you think of, the best story I know is James Watt and pistons. If you have a piston moving inside a cylinder, and it fits too closely, it won't move at all. If it fits too loosely, the gas will escape. And so you want to have it as close to 0 as you can. And his tolerance was the thickness of a worn sixpence, or as you'd say in America, one thin dime. And that's a good definition of just up to 0, but not getting there.
So for all physical purposes, it's the slope of our curve at 3.9 is precisely 6.
We're at that point in the introduction to calculus, the conversation about calculus, where Robert and Ellen Kaplan have explained to us how you can identify the slope of a curve that doesn't have an obvious slope. We've worked our way that far. I think it's time for callers. You got to teach. First rule of teaching is meet them where they're at, right?
Yes, indeed.
1-800 423-8255, the calculus connection with Robert and Ellen Kaplan of the Math Circle. Open today at 1-800-423-TALK. H.W. is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, H.W.
Most people call me Chuck. The lady asked for my first name, and so Chuck doesn't have anything to do with H.W. I wanted to comment. I'm really fascinated with the discussion today that part, if not the biggest discovery that Leibniz and Newton made was not so much the slope of the curve, but the inverse relationship between the slope of the curve and the area under the curve, and the fact that the fundamental theorem of calculus, which was basically what they discovered, was this inverse relationship. And Newton did it, as I think was alluded to, in 1664 to 66, and Leibniz about 10 years later. Prior to both Newton and Leibniz's discovery, other mathematicians of note, especially Fermat, had determined how to find the slope of a curve and determined techniques to do it, but it was this inverse relationship between what we call the integral, what Newton referred to as the fluent, and the fluxion that Newton referred to as the derivative that we now call derivative, which was Leibniz's notation. So I just wanted to add that comment to Professor Kaplan's, or the professor's Kaplan's discussions.
Chuck, H.W., yes. Stand by for a response.
You know, that's a really wonderful point that you've brought up. Half of the calculus has to deal with slopes of lines, derivatives, as we now call them. The other half with areas under curves. We can certainly figure out the area of a rectangle, which is 4 inches high and 7 inches long. 4 times 7 is 28. But what do you do if you take the top off that rectangle and put a curved line there? Harder to figure out the area. You do the same sort of thing. You put little building blocks, little rectangles under it, make them narrower and narrower, take the limit. As these rectangles get very narrow, you'll be able to find out the area. That's the integral. And then this wonderful discovery that the integral and the derivative, the area under a curve and the slope of the curve, are related, that the derivative of the integral is the function you started with. It sounds mysterious, but actually it makes sense, because how the area is determined, what the heights of those little rectangles will be, is, of course, affected by the slope of the curve.
Chuck, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK makes the calculus connection. Jim is calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Hello?
Hello, Jim. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to just mention one of the fun things I think about calculus for me is kind of walking around the world and seeing that things can be explained or pictured with a calculus, like reflectors and flashlights, and why you can whisper to your friend at the other end of a big dome building and nobody else can hear you. And I just think that's neat. And I have two questions I'd like to ask. One is it true, as I've heard, that the fact that the calculus was discovered independently but at the same time came as a result of a contest where somebody was running where there was a mathematical question that was answered quickly and could only have been done so if the answerer knew the calculus? And the second question I'd like to ask is, can your guest give an example where going to the limit, letting things go to the limit of zero, doesn't work? And when your L gets really, really small, then you don't have an answer to your problem after all.
Interesting questions. Jim, thank you. Bob Kaplan.
That first question, in Italy in the Renaissance, there were visiting and wandering professors of division who could go around and give demonstrations in the town square, not just of how to get out of a set of chains or how to emerge from a tub of water without having drowned, but how to divide one number by another. And these exhibitions became more and more intense, more and more sophisticated, and indeed, one of them involved trying to find the largest number you could possibly get under certain circumstances. Those circumstances involved the technique of calculus, born, therefore, in those discussions, but also calculus, I think, has many, many roots. It goes back to the Greeks, to Archimedes. We find it in Cavalieri, great Italian mathematician, in Fermat, as your first caller pointed out. It's a human idea, as all of mathematics is. Mathematics is our lost native language.
I was trying to figure, you know, is it a language? Is it an operating system? Is it an application? I mean, in computer terms, I wondered, first of all, you know, what is the root of, how far would you have to dig into a sort of CAD/CAM design program to find that it's all calculus? But also, does it what does it correspond to in the structure of a computer program?
Whenever there's change, whenever we have change, we have calculus. Computer programs work digitally. They work with zeros and ones, so the changes are by little notches. That's a Leibnizian view of calculus, where you have infinitesimals, and the change occurs over these tiny pebbles. After all, that's what the word calculus comes from, calculi, little stones.
We're talking about the mysteries of motion, variable motion, curves, shapes, a mystery that was anticipated by the Greeks, not solved until the middle of the 17th century, not really understood until well into the 19th century, but we're doing it in an hour today on The Connection with Bob and Ellen Kaplan. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
Swear and thanks.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Calculus Connection with Robert and Ellen Kaplan. This is their sort of math circle on the air. We've just figured out roughly how Newton and Leibniz figured out the slope of a curve that's not a circle. What is the flat angle of a curved surface at a particular point? Now what do we do with it?
Well, we now have something which is going to allow us to deal with real-world driving, because that slope of a line has a name, derivative. And if you're going to be talking about...
Once more, the derivative is the slope?
The slope of the tangent line to the curve.
Is the derivative. In the case we talked about, it was 6.
It was 6.
Okay.
Yep. And it's people came up with a short word because you get tired of saying it is the slope of the line tangent to the curve at the point, which is what the word derivative means. Mm. But years ago, there was a physics course which made beautiful film loops, one of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapsing, and another of a 1920s Maserati racing car, which could go from 0 to 60 in 6 seconds. And they cleverly attached to the wheels devices that could measure distance, which your car already has, and devices that could measure speed, which your car already has, and another device that could measure acceleration. And the pens moved on the graphs as the car was put into gear and pulled out. And you could see that distance is a parabola, and that speed is a straight line rising steeply, and that acceleration is a totally straight horizontal line. So in the technical language, velocity is the derivative of distance, and acceleration is the derivative of velocity. Each curve or straight line, talking about the slope of the line tangent to the function below it in the stack.
So the acceleration was a steady, flat, straight line because that's the slope of a straight line. It's zero.
And also because the Maserati was a really good, heavy racing car.
I'm not quite sure I get that. The acceleration is a straight line.
It means, you'd say in English, the acceleration was constant. It accelerated at the same rate from the moment you put your foot on the gas pedal until it just kept accelerating smoothly.
Second per second,
yeah.
Okay. The speed is, you say, a straight line, but in fact it's changing. It's getting faster.
It's changing. It's a steeply pointing up line because speed is getting faster and faster.
Okay, so why is distance a curve?
You start out not covering very much distance because you're not going very fast. But as you go faster and faster, you cover more distance.
Okay, now where does calculus come in?
Calculus comes in saying I can actually, given any such curve, come up with a function, the derivative function, the derived function, which will describe the, let's say our first function was distance, whatever the function is, our derivative function will describe the velocity. And so you can start talking about such problems as at what speed do I have to set off in order to do something, and you'll be able to get your changes by the functions.
And I guess in our first problem, finding out the slope of x squared at the point 3.9, and we found out the slope was 6, we could have said something more general. The slope of x squared at any point on it is 2x. That's why it was 6 at the point 3.9. It was 2 times the input, 2 times 3.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Is it time for problem number 2 or not? I mean, or is there a useful problem that illustrates what we're doing here?
Yes,
also,
indeed.
Is there a problem that reintroduces into my head that Leibniz's lazy S, that long sign that we always used in solving these things?
Indeed. All of engineering, all of physics, all of science is based on and uses calculus. To use the integral, which figures out the area, among other things, of strangely shaped surfaces, if you want to find the pressure of water on the face of a dam, you would need to use the integral to figure out the surface area of that wall and the pressure on it. If you want to know how much would be left after half a century of a one-pound piece of radioactive material, which has a half-life of, let's say, 500 years, you'd need the integral calculus to figure out that. Doesn't sound as if it's involved with area, but it's involved with the rate of change in this complex way that your first caller pointed out, the relation between the derivative and the integral.
If you think of the integral shorthand as the anti-derivative, so you just are going in the other direction, if you knew the acceleration, you could back-deduce what the speed would be. So this would allow you to figure out how strong you'd have to be to haul a 150-pound mountain climber up a 50-foot cliff, where you're talking about his speed. And then you're saying, what would the force have to be to produce that speed?
Caller's turn. 1-800-423-8255. The calculus connection with Robert and Ellen Kaplan. The math circle. Not to be confused with the zero that Robert Kaplan wrote about so wonderfully in a book called The Nothing That Is, The Natural History of Zero. This is the calculus connection. 1-800-423-8255. Ian is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Ian. Thank you.
You've been talking about all the technical aspects of calculus, which I think is great, but I wanted to ask about something that's, I guess, a corollary to that, and that is how many people generally have a good understanding of calculus and higher math in general, not just being able to calculate the function of a dam or a specific problem, but incorporate it fully into their general worldview.
Besides Robbins and quarterbacks, you mean?
Exactly. You know, on a day-to-day basis, how does it enhance people's lives? You know, without in a general way.
I think the answer, I think there are two answers to your question. Far, far fewer people know it and are comfortable with it than should be, and it affects all of our lives because what we're interested in is change, controlling change, predicting change. Why do so few people know it and feel comfortable with it? I think because calculus, like most of math, is taught so horribly, taught in a boring way, taught in a frightening way. Whereas this is something made by humans for humans and could be enjoyed as an art if one were allowed to play one's way into it.
Hmm. Does that answer it, Ian?
It does. It's I find it very interesting about, you know, the percentage of people who really have an understanding of it. I have, you know, had calculus up through college level, and I think it just really adds an entire dimension to the way you see the world. And I think we should teach it better. So that's all I have to say.
Yeah,
thank you.
Ian, thank you. Ellen Kaplan.
Yeah, more on the same idea, that I like to think the difference between, say, walking and ice skating, where one thing is completely known to you and you don't think about it at all. And the minute you put skates on your feet, you have to start thinking. And I think calculus and understanding of calculus gives you the same sense that everything could be in motion and that you should think about motion and the possibility of change in every aspect of your life.
Ian, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the calculus connection. Jim is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Jim.
Thanks. I'd like to raise an issue that we're getting very close to in the conversation here, having to do with democratizing access to the ideas of calculus. As the guests have pointed out, the basic ideas of calculus involve understanding change and of varying quantities and how those quantities accumulate, particularly quantities that accumulate over time. And that relationship is really at the heart of the thing. And it took some hundreds of years to develop this fancy thing that we call calculus, but which, in fact, as a course, highly institutionalized through our educational system, is actually reached by only about 10 to 12% of the population, which means that roughly 90% don't get it.
Hmm.
These very, very important ideas are bottled up at the end of a long list of prerequisites. Now, it turns out that through the use of the computational medium and simulations, visualization tools, and so on, many of the ideas at the heart of calculus can be made learnable by mainstream students beginning at the middle school level if they're given a chance. I run a project that is all about that. Hmm. And we found that given a chance, kids can in fact learn that stuff. And so democratization is in fact possible.
What's your school, Jim? And just how do you begin at it?
Well, it's the school is UMass Dartmouth. And I run a project funded by the National Science Foundation called the SimCalc Project, www.simcalc.umassd.edu. And we begin with motion simulations of exactly in the theme that folks have been talking about, and provide students with the opportunity, for example, to control the motion of cars and see velocity and position graphs, et cetera. And see the relationships between position, velocity, and acceleration, and bring it to life in that way, while simultaneously trying to build some of the other basic and important ideas that folks already feel responsible to cover in those grades, like rate, ratio, proportion, slope, linearity, interpretation of graphs, and all that.
Mm.
But I think it's really important, as your guests have pointed out, to make these ideas accessible to the broad population, because they are, as the previous caller indicated, a really important means by which we make sense of our lives, make financial judgments, plan for retirement if you get old enough, and so on.
Jim, this is valuable. You say 10% of the population gets to calculus. I'm surprised it's that high, if it is. You agree, I take it, Robert and Ellen, that it can be introduced as a framework for thinking long before sort of advanced placement and senior year in high school.
Absolutely. I think that the intuition for calculus is right there. I mean, after all, outfielders do catch baseballs. They understand they're solving differential equations. I think two interesting things have happened with calculus, which have put it in this odd elitist position. One is, well, Holmos, a great mathematician, said the reason all calculus books are so bad is that there are 1,000 different things which are called the calculus, which are shoved into a course. Another difficulty is that since people don't have to learn Latin anymore, calculus has become the sort of pons asinorum to say, can anybody do extraordinarily hard work? If it's not going to be Latin, it's going to be calculus. But the intuition is right there and can be used early on. And if the intuition is really strong, then when rigor comes along to actually prove that these things are true, as opposed to seeing them and feeling them, you have something which is not just the kind of dull formula memorizing which most high school and college calculus classes turn into.
Do you want to recommend a book? I mean, I searched the web on calculus in the last few days, and I must say you find a lot of courses, and you find even sort of an edited list of good courses. I didn't find the one I was looking for, though.
Well, I just wanted to add to what Ellen said, that in the math circle, we teach calculus to 9-year-olds by having them discover it for themselves. There's a wonderful book written in the 1890s by a man with an equally wonderful name, Sylvanus Thompson, Calculus Made Easy. It's not dumbed down. It's not for idiots. It's the real stuff, but written in clear language. And
in print?
In print, I believe.
Okay. On the web, that would be asking too much, but we'll check it out. Sylvanus Thompson, Calculus Made Easy. 1-800-423-8255, The Calculus Connection. Matt is on the line.
Hi there.
Hello, Matt. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I'd like to touch on a bunch of topics that have already been brought up. I hate to be repetitive. This topic intrigues me in the same way that knowing a vocabulary of a language and yet not knowing the syntax or how to put things together might annoy someone who's trying to read. I've had a lot of calculus in my education and yet never understood it. I forced myself to take it and never could grasp it. I feel that there's a world out there that I don't understand because I don't have the tools or the context to put things together. And yet the guests you have on your show have sort of, I mean, suddenly a lot of the things that I've spent years trying to understand and more years trying to avoid have made sense. You've touched upon the different problems in education. I'm one of those people where it's been available to me, and yet I've been unable to grasp it, and I have always thought that I've had a non-mathematical mind of some sort. And I was wondering if that is the case, if there are people who grasp it and some people who don't, or if it is a fault in the way it's proffered to everyone.
I'm sure it's the latter. I think we all have minds for mathematics. Mathematics is our way of conversing with the world, and it with us. It's so badly taught. One's so put off by math at every level, adding fractions, coming on the variable x in the eighth or ninth grade, calculus, the last great stumbling block, when it's all so intuitive, it could be all so much fun. And we found that with the kids we teach. Youngest is 5 and the oldest is 50, and we have fun with them because we're discovering things and making mistakes together.
Matt, thank you, and good luck. Keep doing it. 1-800-423-8255. Mitchell is calling from Buffalo, New York.
Hi.
Welcome, Mitchell.
I'm bursting with enthusiasm, but let me go back to the first comment I had to make. You, Christopher, brought up the question of, is mathematics a language, or is it a computer program, or is it a code?
Or an operating system or something.
Or an operating system, right. And I just wanted to quote a quote. I'm an economist, and my old teacher, Paul Samuelson, put on the front of his first famous book a quotation from the American physicist Willard Gibbs, "Mathematics is a language." I won't go into the history of where the quote came from. But as a longtime teacher of mathematics and mathematics for economists and so on, I find getting this kind of idea across important. That is, the symbols that the students see in front of them when they're doing a calculation should make perfectly good linguistic sense. They should translate into whatever their native language is. In the case of graduate students, it's likely to be Chinese or Japanese or Indian or English. But the mathematical language translates. You can talk about it. That translates into what one of your guests said, that it's the way we talk to the world. The mathematics is translatable into all the different ways that people converse and learn.
Okay, Mitchell, all right, mathematics is a language. What then is calculus?
Calculus is a particular, what shall I say, dialect of that language?
Is it French? Is it Japanese?
You can do calculus in French or Japanese or English. Or, again, to quote Samuelson, if you do it without symbols, you are, in effect, using a shovel when the calculus symbols make it quicker and easier. A steam shovel, if you will. But you can, in fact, talk your way through these calculations. And as the teachers who are with you will tell you, in fact, they've already demonstrated it, the calculations were translated for everybody, right? They went up on the web in a picture, but over the radio, you heard them translated into English.
Ellen Kaplan?
Well, it's very hard to do math without pictures, but one picture being worth a thousand words. And I think one of the ways it proves math is a language is that people start by being perfectly willing to write nonsense, because symbols look as meaningless as characters in a different syllabary. And then gradually, as you become more familiar, you begin to see how, oh, this couldn't possibly make sense. And eventually you get that well-known phenomenon of a mathematician sitting in a library in front of a bunch of symbols and bursting out laughing. Then you realize he is a master of the language.
Mitchell? Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. David is in Mansfield, Massachusetts.
Hi, good morning, Chris.
Morning, David.
Thanks to your guests. Excellent topic. I'll be brief. You only have a couple minutes left. I'm an engineer turned marketing person, but I live a lot in the high-tech world. And I just wanted to make the statement that as much as I love teaching higher-level mathematics to as many kids as possible in school, I think it's difficult because there are so many subjects that kids going through middle school and high school need to learn about, that concentrating on advanced mathematics like calculus, which is intrinsically a difficult subject, is tough for them because there are so many other things to learn. And the other point I just want to make is that calculus, in my mind, as an engineer, is a way of describing the world around us. And you don't necessarily need to be fluent in the mathematical concepts of derivatives or integrals to describe what goes on in the world or even to live in the world. People use calculus all the time. It's part of their innate sort of intuitive actions in what they do when you throw a baseball or when you go roller skating or rollerblading. You're using calculus all the time. You just don't think of it. It's just embedded in sort of the way you do things in the physics of how you move your body.
Certainly the center fielder who moves at the crack of the bat anticipating the direction, the speed, the depth of that fly ball knows a whole lot about calculus. Does that help in teaching it or not?
Well, I think that we see here how deep mathematics is in our minds, in our grasp of the world, but I do think we'd like to bring that depth out into the open, into our languages, into our conscious thoughts, so we can deal with it, so that we can gain control over and understanding of the beauties of the world. The whole point of mathematics is to shed light on the world and on our minds. Calculus is one of the most brilliant beams in that white light.
The next trick is to get the mathematicians of the world, especially the ones on the internet, to write with the grace and the patience and the user-friendliness that you do, Robert Kaplan, and to talk about it, Ellen, the way you both do. More power to the math circle. Listeners, if you want to learn a little more, continue the calculus conversation, try our website at theconnectiononeword.org. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Dan First, Will Smith, Jake Shapiro, Thomas Terry, Rebecca Smuckler, Kim Bichari, and Av Harris. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our approximation of Isaac Newton. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Just ahead on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to all the latest news, a look at why the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forest has singled out a 25-acre plot of virgin